I've checked it out, and the brand belongs to some of the Sackett family.
I've heard of them. Killers, aren't they?
No, Bess, they are not. You'd ride many a mile to find better citizens or men than them Sacketts. They're mountain people from Tennessee, but good folks. They've done some shooting here and there, but this is a hard country, Bess, and it needs hard men to settle it.
That's why I want to move, Borden. I want to go back east. I want to go to Vermont.
What would I do there, Bess? I don't know anything but cattle.
You could farm. You could get some kind of a job.
Bess, he said patiently, we've been over this time and again. There's 50 men in this town that used to farm back east and couldn't make it. Now they are here, some of them doing well. I'd never fit in back there, Bess.
I'm afraid, Borden. I'm afraid you'll be killed. You've been shot at several times.
Oh, I know.
You didn't tell me about it, but Pris did. Everybody in town is talking about it, and she likes you, you know. She always has.
I'll be all right. Men never built anything, Bess, without there was some dying and some suffering. I don't want to die. All I want is to be with you and Tom, but I'm doing a job somebody has to do. And who else is there?
Lang Adams. He's at least single.
Not for long. He's courting Blossom Gailey.
I know. She's a fine woman. A little, well, she's been around men too much, out on that ranch. She's a little too free-talking. She's just grown up with all those cowboys around.
Lang could do worse, believe me.
Borden, I wasn't going to tell you, but, well, I heard something last night, too.
When?
You were asleep. I heard something, but I didn't get up. Somebody was around the barn, Borden. I lifted the curtain a little, and I could just make him out, not who it was, but it was a man. He went into the barn, then came out. He came up to the back porch and looked through the screen.
And you didn't call me?
Borden, you'd have come out of a deep sleep, and he was already out there in the dark. He'd have had every advantage.
He pushed back from the table and went outside, studying the ground. A few blurred tracks, the edge of a boot sole, clean cut and sharp.
In the barn he found a half inch of a heel track. It was sharply cut.
New boots, or almost new.
He remembered his one thin clue. Lying on the floor of the mule barn after he had been hit, he had grabbed out and his fingers had slipped off a boot. A well-polished boot that felt almost new.
Borden Chantry walked back into the house, liking the smell of bacon frying. He could hear the boys stirring around in their room as he sat down. He was going to have to pay attention to boots. He was going to have to find somebody who wore brand new boots. And that reminded him that he had to see Hyatt Johnson. Today. And he had to see Marianne Haley.
When he got up from the table and reached for his hat, Bess turned around, a fork in her hand. Borden, be careful.
He walked outside in the bright morning sun and looked toward the McCoy house.
How could he be careful when he had no idea who he had to be careful of?
Somebody in town wanted to kill him. Somebody in town was getting very, very worried. For somebody, time was running out. Somebody who had shot before and would again at any instant.
Chapter 11. It was early for the bank to be open. So after a walk along the street to see if all was well, stopping to speak to Blazer and Elsie, Chantry strolled back to the Bon Ton, took his usual seat, and waited for Ed to bring him coffee. Two drummers sat in the corner, and a cowboy from west of town was sitting, hat tilted back, dusty, spurred boots tucked back under his chair, cooling his coffee in his saucer. He looked to be all of 17, but that was a common age for cowhands. In fact, one of the greatest herds ever taken out of Texas to the north had been in charge of a man, and he was definitely a man, of just 17. Responsibility, like hard work, came very young on the western ranges. He had scarcely seated himself when Prissy came in. He could see at once that something was worrying her. She looked around quickly and crossed immediately to his table and sat down opposite him.
Her eyes were large with excitement.
Marshall, as soon as I saw you on the street, I came running. Marshall, you've got to be careful.
Well, I try to be, Prissy. What's wrong?
Did you ever hear of Boone Silva?
He felt a sudden emptiness in his stomach.
I have, he said. Why?
Marshall.
She leaned closer.
Somebody here in town wrote to him.
They've got the right, he said, if they know where he lives.
They knew all right. Marshall, that letter was mailed in one of them cheap kind of envelopes they sell over to the store. Everybody uses them.
And it was printed. The address was printed, like whoever sent it didn't want the handwriting recognized.
Private business, Prissy. It is none of my affair.
She sat back in her chair.
Isn't it now? Why would anybody from here be sending word to a hired gunman? There's no cattle war on. No trouble of any kind except what you bought for yourself when you began hunting that murderer.
Somebody shot at you, Marshall. Somebody hit you on the head. Somebody killed poor Johnny McCoy. I think when you got George Riggins' saddle...
How did you know about that? He demanded sharply.
Marshall, you've lived here long enough. Nobody has any secrets in this town.
Mrs. Riggin told Elsie that George wanted you to have his saddle. Now, why would you want another saddle? If he was going to give it to somebody, why not little Billy McCoy, who got his bridle? Everybody just naturally figures there had to be some reason. You know, that maybe George was trying to tell you something?
Well, when I saw that letter to Boone Silva, I just knew it was account of you.
Somebody wants you dead, Marshall. Somebody wants you dead almighty bad. Now you just watch. In a few days he'll come riding into town and...
You sent the letter?
Had to. It's my bounden duty. All the same, you being the law, I figured you ought to know.
Thanks, Percy. He filled his cup. Then he thought of the obvious question. Where did the letter go to, Percy?
Trinidad.
She filled her own cup.
Marshall, it makes a body wonder. How did whoever wrote that letter know where to find him?
The way I heard it, Silva was around Tascosa, and if not there, Las Vegas.
How did whoever wrote that letter know to write him in Trinidad?
It was a good question. A very good question. Borden Chantry stared into his cup. God, he thought, don't let Bess hear about this. Silva was a gunfighter. He'd been an outlaw, had done time in prison, and lately had been riding for various ranches around the country, driving nesters off the land. He had killed 3 or 4 men in gun battles, and it was said a half dozen more should be added to the list. But who knew about that? Don't say anything about this, Prissy, he warned.
Yet even as he said it,
he knew what a talker she was, and doubted she could keep the story even if she tried.
Her next comment reassured him.
Don't worry. You think I want that man to know I told you that? He might decide to kill me.
I just won't tell anybody, Marshall, and don't you neither.
She got up and left just as Blossom gaily came into the room. She saw him at once and crossed to his table.
Hi, Board. It's good to see you. Seen Lang this morning?
No, I haven't. Sit down, Blossom. I've been meaning to ride out your way.
Now, Board, you know better than that. Why, you're a married man with a family.
He blushed, and she laughed, delighted. I didn't mean that, he protested. I just wanted to talk to you about George Riggin.
George?
Her face saddened.
That was bad. Real bad. I liked old George. He was a real man. Don't find his kind around much anymore.
Then she looked at him.
What about him, Borden? If there's anything I can help you with, you just let me know.
He was coming out to see you when he was killed. Had you sent for him?
Me? I should say not. Why would I need the law? If anybody gave me any trouble, I've got a Winchester. That's all the law I need on my land, because if anybody was troubling me, it would be rustlers, and I'd take care of that myself, just like Pa used to.
Better leave it to the law, Blossom.
What law?
You're the town marshal. You've got no jurisdiction out yonder. We've got us a county sheriff I hear, but I've never seen him. Maybe there's a United States marshal in Denver. But how does that help me? By the time I got to him and he got here, my cows would be in Mexico.
He wanted to talk to you, Blossom. Have you got any idea what it was about?
She hesitated. Just a moment too long. No, not really, Borden. George was like a second father to me, in some ways. He was a good man, but he never trusted anybody very much, and he was always afraid I'd get into trouble.
You don't know why he suddenly decided he had to see you?
No,
she said again, more quickly this time.
He did not persist, yet the idea remained that she did know why George Riggin had been coming to see her, or had an idea.
Why, then, would she not tell him?
For a moment his thoughts returned to Boone Silva. The man was notoriously fast with a gun, at a dead shot. Suppose Priscilla was right, and he was being sent for to kill him. How would he stack up with Silva? He had never considered himself a gunfighter, and had dodged any suggestion of the kind. He was good with a gun, but he'd never had any idea of matching skills with anyone. This was for crazy kids. He had no idea of killing anyone.
Yet supposing he was faced with it, right here on the street.
He shook his head to clear away the thought. He would straddle that bronc when time put a saddle on it. For now, he had too much else to do.
You don't mind if I sit here?
Blossom asked suddenly.
I'm waiting for Lang.
Sorry, I was wool gathering. Got a lot to think about these days.
Who would know about Silva?
Kim Baca, of course. Kim knew all the men who followed the outlaw trail. He got up suddenly. Blossom, stick around, will you? I want to talk to you again. I've got to run up to the bank now.
Oh, I'll be in town. There's a dance, or didn't you know? Lang's taking me.
You'd better talk to Bess. She liked dancing. And oddly enough, for a man who was not very social, he liked it too. And they all said he was good. Well, maybe. He walked up the street, watching people from habit. At the bank, he turned and looked down the street again. Supposing somebody had sent for Silva to kill him, would Silva be likely to shoot from ambush or face him somewhere? If Kim Baca did not know, Time Reardon might. Would he get an honest answer from Time? He considered that and decided he would. Time would tell him. No matter how it was. Well, that was what he wanted. He entered the bank, and the teller motioned with his head toward Johnson's office. The banker looked up as Chantry came in.
Ah, how are you, Chantry? Sorry I was so short with you the other day, but I am rather jealous of my files. People like to keep their financial affairs a secret, you know, so I hesitated.
What did Sackett want?
Hyatt hesitated only for a minute.
He opened an account. He gave me a check for $3,000 on a bank in Santa Fe.
$3,000? Chantry dropped into a chair.
Did he give you any idea why he was depositing it?
As a matter of fact, he did. Hyatt Johnson sat back in his swivel chair. It must be confidential, of course. He was anxious that she know nothing about it until he had done some checking. He wanted to see if there was any man around who might be taking money from her.
Her.
Marianne Haley.
They stared at each other, and then Johnson shook his head.
It isn't what you might think. Sackett explained it very quickly, very simply. A few years ago, there was an epidemic in a western mining camp. Marianne Haley, risking her own health, nursed a number of men through their illness, and one of them was a Sackett.
Well, you've heard about the Sacketts. They pay their debts. Somebody came through Mora and happened to tell them that Marianne was sick, that she needed to change her climate, but didn't have the money. That was all they needed to know. Several Sacketts put up money, and Joe started over the trail, part of it in cash, and the rest in a draft on that bank in Santa Fe. He went to see her, but he wasn't satisfied.
You know how it is. Often those girls are keeping some man on the side who simply takes all their money, and Joe wanted to look into the situation before he gave her the rest of the money. He also wanted to make up his mind whether she should have it all, or just a drawing account. He deposited the check with me, and he left his saddlebags.
Saddlebags?
Hyatt Johnson turned toward the big safe. It was an old safe, no longer used for the day-to-day banking business, but as a place of safekeeping for valuables of local people or travelers. Opening the safe, he took out a pair of worn saddlebags and dropped them on the desk.
You'll have to sign for them, Marshal. It isn't that I do not trust you, but they were left to me for safekeeping.
Sure, I'll sign. Borden Chantry got to his feet. Thanks, Hyatt. This is a help. Now, for the first time, I really know why he came to town. It helps.
Hyatt pushed a sheet of paper to him, and Borden signed. As he was signing his name, Hyatt added,
Marshal, Sackett was carrying gold. A good deal of it.
How much?
Johnson shrugged.
Several $100s. Maybe more. It was in a money belt and a sack he had tucked under his coat. It was heavy. I could tell from the way he moved.
Thanks. Johnson sat back in his chair again. Chantry moved to the door of the office. I'll talk to Marianne.
Hyatt Johnson shifted in his chair.
Chantry? I'd be careful. Be damned careful. They've missed up until now, when they've tried for you. But they didn't miss with Johnny McCoy or with Sackett.
His route down the street took him past the Corral Saloon. He paused in the door, then went in. Two men were playing cards at one of the tables, and a freighter was at the bar with a beer.
Tim Reardon was polishing a glass when Chantry came in, and he put it down and walked to the far end of the bar to meet him. He took the cigar from his teeth.
Something for you, Marshal?
A little conversation. Chantry rested his thick forearms on the edge of the bar. What do you know about Boone Silva?
Reardon took the cigar from his teeth.
I have never done any business with him, he said slowly. But the word is that he's a dangerous man.
Would he kill a man for hire?
Reardon smiled.
He'd kill a man for hire. He'd kill a man for fun. And he might just kill him to get him out of the way. The man's completely without conscience or scruples, Chantry. And anybody who deals with him is begging for trouble. He's a man of about 5'9" or 10". Weighs about 160, I'd say. He's a dark, swarthy man with black hair but pale blue eyes. Kind of a glassy look to them. The top of one of his ears is cut cleanly off. I don't know how. But he usually keeps it covered with hair. He's good with any kind of a gun, and he'll shoot you from the front or the back.
That's what I wanted to know. What to expect.
Reardon took up his cigar. Whiskey? He suggested.
I'll have a beer.
Reardon poured himself a drink.
Rarely touch the stuff, he said frankly. It doesn't mix well with business. Or guns. Or cards.
He took a bottle from under the bar and a glass. He filled the glass with beer.
Is he coming here?
After you?
I don't know, but there's a suggestion that he might.
Chantry tasted the beer.
Reardon, I don't know much about such things. What would it cost to hire a man like that?
Reardon smiled and shrugged.
Marshal, Silva would kill a sheep herder or a cook or a drifter for $50. For a nester, it would cost $100, if he had a family.
For me?
$200. Maybe more. There are some who say you are very good with a gun yourself. He'd want at least $200, and he'd want the odds.
Reardon dusted the ashes from his cigar.
He'd want you armed, so he would have an excuse. But he'd try to pick a time when you weren't ready. Suppose you've been having coffee over at the Bon Ton, and you start to rise from the table. Often a man will rest a hand on the table or a chair in rising, or you grasp the pommel of your saddle,
preparing to mount. He'll pick a time that works for him, Marshal. And he won't miss.
200. That's a fair chunk of money.
It is that.
Reardon smiled, but his eyes were cold.
Not many men in town could ante up that kind of money. I suspect Johnson could.
Blazer might.
Blossom Gailey could.
Why Blossom?
She's got money enough.
Whether she has the reason,
I wouldn't know.
If I were you, Marshal,
I'd not rule anybody out who could pay $200.
Including you. Reardon chuckled.
Including me.
He looked straight into Chantry's eyes.
But that's a lot of money to spend, Marshal, when I own a Winchester.
You left somebody out, Chantry said.
Who?
Mary Ann Haley, he said, and drank the last of his beer.
Chapter 12
Borden Chantry walked south on Main Street until he was past the Mexican Cafe, then turned along the well-worn path toward Mary Ann's house, which stood back by itself in a small grove of trees. It was a square white house on which a small addition had been built, a porch across the front, shaded by several big old cottonwoods. There was a stable in back and a hitching rail in front. He saw no horses as he approached, no sign of life other than a thin trail of smoke from the chimney. He paused in the shade of the nearest cottonwood. There was a slight breeze there, and it felt cool. He removed his hat and wiped his hatband. He did not like what he had to do. Questioning women was something he would never like, and especially as Mary Ann was sick. Was she a suspect? Sackett had been to her house, and he had been carrying considerable money. He had brought the money for her, and had more waiting in the bank. But did she know that? Mary Ann had no boyfriend hanging around. If she had, everybody in town would have known it. Lucy Marie, now, she was sweet on one of the riders out at the O Bar O, sometimes called the Dumbbell. Chantry went up the steps, spurs jingling a little. The boards creaked under his weight. He tapped on the door. It opened at once, almost as if he had been expected. Lucy Marie answered the door.
Marshal, won't you come in?
He stepped in, removing his hat. How are you, Lucy? Is Mary Ann in?
You come and sit down, Marshal. I'll go tell Mary Ann you're here.
As she left the room, he glanced around. It might have been any parlor in any house in town, except there was a piano, and he knew of only one other in town, and that was in the church.
No, that was an organ.
The carpets were a little thicker. The furniture was velvet or something that looked like it. There was a lot of red, and it was a little brighter than he'd expect to find in most houses. The curtains parted, and he looked around at Mary Ann Haley, rising to his feet as she entered.
How do you do? He said. I'm sorry to disturb you.
It is all right, Marshal. I feel a little better today.
I'm investigating the murder of Joe Sackett.
So I assumed. Do you want to know what I know about him? Or is it something else?
Before he could reply, she turned her head.
Lucy, make us some tea, will you?
She glanced at him.
She was a pale, quite lovely woman, he decided. And on this day she wore a gingham dress in blue and white with a square-cut collar with some lace around it and on the cuffs. He wasn't much good at such things, but he looked because he knew Bess would be curious. Disapproving, but curious.
You do drink tea, don't you, Marshal?
Anything. Oh, sure. But you needn't bother.
It's quite all right.
She was visibly thinner than when he had last seen her, and she had always given the impression of being frail, unusual in women of her kind in this part of the country. And she was no youngster. 40? Maybe. And maybe younger, for she'd had quite a life. He remembered patches of stories he'd heard here and there. Her folks had been killed by Indians nearly 30 years back, and she had been taken up by foster parents who'd been none too good to her.
She'd run off, joined a traveling show, had married an actor who ran off and left her when she grew ill. She had been in California, then Nevada. That was where she had stuck by the boys when they got sick and risked her life to help them through their illness. She'd been known in Virginia City, Pioche, Leadville, and Tin Cup, and some said she had worked the cattle towns further east. Somewhere along the line, she had taken up with a gambler, but he had been killed when a stage overturned. Since then, there had been nobody.
You wanted to ask about Joe Sackett. I had never met him until he rode into town. One of his brothers was ill out west, and I helped nurse him to health, along with some other men. He heard I was in trouble, and Joe came to bring me some money.
How much?
$500, to start. They said there would be more when I got located out on the coast.
Joe Sackett gave you $500. You know how much more he had?
I've no idea, but he did have more. I saw it.
Was there anybody else here that night?
It was morning when he first came, but I wasn't awake yet. He came back later. He explained why he had come and that his brother and several others had contributed. They said I had helped them. They wished to help me. I was to take the money and go to San Diego, where another one of the miners I helped had a house in which I could live. The climate would be right for me, and the money would care for me.
Pretty nice, Chantry said. Did you talk about anything else?
Well, he asked about the town and the people. He did say something to the effect that he'd seen a man on the street whom he thought he remembered from New Mexico.
Did he describe him?
Oh, no. And I thought nothing of it, because a lot of the men from here have been down there. Some of the cowhands from the ranches try to work further south when the cold weather comes. Can't blame them. It's cold out on that range.
Don't I know, Chantry agreed grimly.
Lucy brought the tea and sat quietly. He sipped his tea while she talked of western mining camps and the hard times. What did he know, after all? That Joe Sackett had come to town to help Marianne, that he had given her some money, that he had deposited more in the bank, and that he had left. He had been assaulted by Kearns and Hurley, had taken care of them, but had never arrived at the hotel. Somebody had shot him in the back. But where? Sackett had his coat off at the time. Why? Sackett was no tenderfoot, so how had somebody come up behind him? Was it somebody he knew and trusted?
Was there anybody else here at the time?
There was nobody here in the morning, she said thoughtfully. Not when he came, at least. And when he came back?
She paused, thinking.
Well, I've forgotten. There were several here, not for business, just dropping in to visit or have a drink.
Do you know Boone Silva? He asked suddenly. Her expression did not change. She shrugged one slender shoulder.
I've heard of him.
The second time he was here, he suggested. I mean, Sackett. What time did he leave?
She had the cup almost to her lips, but she stopped and put it down.
Why, I don't remember. He was here, and he was reading a magazine he picked up. I had grown tired, so I went up to bed. Maybe Lucy can tell you.
Lucy shook her head.
Yes, he was here. He read the paper and drank some coffee.
Nothing else?
No, I don't think he drank. Coffee was all he had. After he read the paper, he went to wash his hands, and then came back. And right after that, he left.
Did he say where he was going? What he was going to do?
Marianne offered him a room here.
She looked up at Chantry.
We have extra rooms. Sometimes people we know do stay over, and sometimes when somebody has too much to drink, we put them in one of the spare rooms. But he said he would go to the hotel.
She paused, suddenly frowning.
You know, when he left, I thought maybe he wasn't feeling well. I asked him again to stay, but he just shook his head and went on. Once I thought he was going to fall, and I started toward him, but he straightened up and went on.
On? To where?
Some had said he was staggering, looking like he might be drunk.
but he drank little, if at all. He had only coffee.
Lucy Marie, I want you to think. Who made the coffee?
Why, I did. I usually do, although once in a while Marianne would.
Doped coffee? For what purpose? He had already given them money and planned to give Marianne more.
Lucy Marie? He looked at her thoughtfully.
Lucy Marie and somebody else, trying for a little money on their own.
He doubted it.
Yet the thought was there.
Was Blazer in here that night? I need witnesses, he said then. Somebody who can tell me where Sackett was going, what he planned to do.
Marianne spoke reluctantly. What men do who come here is their own business, and I don't want to know or ask questions unless they feel like talking. Some of them are lonely, and they just want to talk. We're used to that. Some of the cowboys never see a woman for months at a time, and when they come in, they want to talk. They're just lonely, as much as anything. Yes, Mr. Blazer was here, but so was Hyatt Johnson and Lang Adams. They were just sort of making the rounds, I guess.
Tim Reardon came by, too,
Lucy Marie commented.
But he didn't stay long. He was looking for somebody, I think.
Borden Chantry finished his tea. He put the cup down carefully. It was elegant china, and he tried to identify the pattern so he could tell Bess about it. That coffee, he said. Were you alone in the kitchen when you made it?
Oh, Lord, no,
Lucy Marie laughed.
That kitchen is the busiest room in the house. There's always somebody coming or going.
He stayed a little longer, asked a few more questions, and wished he could think of something to ask that might uncover some information he could use. But he was no good at questions.
Still, he had an idea there had been something in that coffee, for Sackett seemed to have been affected soon after drinking it. There seemed to be no reason why either of the girls would have doped his coffee. Yet something happened to Sackett, something that left him staggering and uncertain after leaving Marianne's. At the door he said goodbye, put on his hat, and drew the door shut behind him. For an instant he stood there, his eyes sweeping the terrain before him. Then he moved into the shade of the nearest cottonwood and stood again. Where had Sackett been going when he left Marianne's?
Logic said the hotel. He had left his horse earlier at McCoy's. He had no reason to go anywhere except the hotel, or perhaps to the Mexican cafe or the Bon Ton to eat. Supposedly, he was a stranger in town.
Had he met somebody at Marianne's?
There'd been no mention of it. Yet it could have happened.
Had he encountered someone after leaving Marianne's?
Looking due north and some 300 yards away was the old freight barn where Chantry had been wrapped on the skull. Less than 100 yards off, the Mexican cafe. And across the street and just a bit farther, the McCoy place. His own place was about 300 yards to the northwest, and mostly west, so as he walked away he began to retrace the steps Sackett had taken. It was sandy, weed-covered ground with a few scattered patches of prickly pear. Near the Mexican cafe there were a couple of trees, and his own house stood in a cluster of them.
Supposing Sackett had been hot. Supposing he had himself removed his coat, carrying it over his arm. Supposing also that instead of going directly to the street west of Marianne's, he had gone northwest, past the back of the Mexican cafe. The corral saloon, except for the door at the rear, had a blank wall. The old freight barn was empty and deserted. There would have been a moment there when Sackett was not in the view of anybody.
There was no use looking for tracks at this late date, for aside from the element of time, numerous dogs, children, and occasional horses or cattle had walked or been driven over the area in passing from one place to another.
Another thought came to him. The arroyo in which he had found the saddle was only a little way off to the east.
Again he came back to the thought of motive.
Someone with a hate for the Sackett family?
The desire for the gold he carried?
Yet how could that fit into the killing of Pin Dover, and of George Riggin, if he was killed, and of Johnny McCoy?
Or was there any connection at all? Riggin had believed Dover's death was murder.
Why?
and Dover had been punching cows in the Mora area where Sackett came from. It was a feeble connection, but at least a connection. He started suddenly toward the freight barn.
Yet when he had taken no more than a dozen steps, he turned sharply left, and in a few steps had the Mexican cafe between himself and the town.
He went on home. Bess was sewing when he came into the house. She looked up.
Are you all right?
Sure, he said. Might tired is all. He dropped into a chair, putting his hat on the table, his spurs jingling as he moved his boots to an easier position. So, Marianne. Bess looked up.
How is she?
Frail, he said. Frail. Sackett was bringing her money. Enough so she could go out to the coast. Seems a lot of the miners she nursed through that epidemic think highly of her.
He described her appearance as best he could, and told of the parlor and its furniture, the few pictures, and whatever he could remember.
I don't see what all you men see in her, Bess said stiffly. She's really not very pretty. And she's so thin. Well, she's sick. But it isn't only her, Bess. Some of the men go there because it's a place to meet, and she has the latest newspapers there. Why, she's got more papers than I knew was published, and magazines, too.
He tips back in his chair.
Damned if I can make head or tail of it, Bess. I guess I'm just not cut out for this job.
Why bother? The man's dead, isn't he? You can't bring him back. Maybe he needed killing.
A man who would ride a couple of 100 miles to bring money to a sick woman? No, he didn't need killing. But somebody thought he did.
I don't think it was the money. I think somebody was scared. What about Kimbaka? You told me that he'd admitted planning to steal Sackett's horse.
Right, but he's a horse thief, not a killer. Not that he couldn't if he had to. He's faster than most.
What he should do, he reflected, was get a tablet and write it all out. Who his suspects were, what there was to make him suspect each, and where they were at the times of the shootings.
Suddenly he flushed, embarrassed that he had not thought of that.
Where, for example, had each of them been when Johnny was shot? When he was slugged?
He was a fool. Old George Riggan would have been smarter than that.
Riggan. Only then did he remember the thin notebook he had taken from the hidden saddle pocket. It might hold all the answers.
Chapter 13. He said nothing about the book. It was the usual little notebook, the sort many ranchers called a tally book, and in which they kept count of cattle out on the range or notes on range conditions. Most men carried such things in their heads, but if you ran a lot of stock, such a tally book was handy.
Supposing George had actually named a name? Supposing that book held the solution to the crimes? Was that what he wanted? Or was he afraid of what he might find there?
After all, he knew everybody in town, was friendly with them all, even Tim Reardon, and the killer had to be one of them.
He turned it over in his mind, sorting out the little he had learned, trying to find a pattern. The killer, he thought then, would be nervous. The killer knew him, although he did not know the killer, and the killer would be watching his every step, seeing when he got close, laughing when he drifted away from the truth. Yet there was another point to be considered. The killer might be getting nervous. What was the old saying? The guilty flee when no man pursueth. Supposing the killer believed he was closer to a solution than he was.
Of course, that had already happened, for the killer had tried to kill him. Or warn him off. The boys came in for supper, and he glanced at Billy, who hastily averted his eyes.
Now what was the matter with him?
Acted as if he was guilty of something. But that was silly. Next thing he'd be suspecting Bess. Or Tom. There was much talk, as usual. But his mind was elsewhere. His thoughts reverted to Boone Silva. Silva could be riding into town any time in the next few days, and he would choose his time carefully. Borden Chantry had one small advantage. Boone Silva would not realize that he was expected.
It might make all the difference in the world.
When supper was over, he watched the boys help Bess wash and dry the dishes. Then he took a cup of coffee and went into the parlor. Bess looked around in surprise when he opened the door, for the parlor was rarely used except to receive the preacher or some other notable, but tonight he wanted to be alone.
"I've got to study on this," he said.
"Of course," she agreed. It was not the quietest place with the boys around, but he enjoyed their presence nonetheless. As he went through the door, he picked up Sackett's saddlebags. Seated on the sofa, he rested them between his feet and unbuckled the straps. He hesitated a moment, some inner delicacy making him uncomfortable at thus invading the privacy of another man's belongings. He was himself an essentially private man, friendly but reserved, standing a cool sentry before the doors of his personal life. He had equal respect for the privacy of others. Suddenly, his hands froze where they were. That strap, the one he had just unbuckled, had been fastened in the next to the loosest hole, and that wasn't logical. A man carrying anything in saddlebags would cinch them tight so nothing would be lost. Yet if someone had gone into the bags and had been in a hurry to strap them up, they might have been left just so. He shook his head irritably. Who around here would do a thing like that? Bess? Certainly not. Tom? No. Billy? He thought about that. No, Billy was an honest boy, and he knew him as such. There had been countless times when Billy might have picked up something around town, but he never had. He reached into the saddlebag and took out a small sack of .44s, a square of pemmican, and a small sack of cold flour, an emergency ration often carried on the trail in earlier days. There was a tight coil of rawhide string, perhaps 10 or 12 feet of it, such as a man might carry for rigging snares, use as piggin strings, or a variety of ways around a campfire or on the range. It was something handy to have, often useful. In the other bag there was little else, a spare bandana, a small packet of letters, some writing materials, and some odds and ends that might have been carried by any man riding across country. The letters, all but one, were addressed to Joe Sackett. That one was addressed to Tyrell Sackett. Two were from a girl in Santa Fe, the very formal letters of the time, yet betraying a deep interest. The first was obviously a love letter. The second was almost identical to the first in tone, telling the small happenings of every day, urging him to come for a visit, and expressing anxiety about his trip, obviously this one, from which Joe Sackett would not return. There was a quiet sweetness in the letters that was touching, despite the formal language. Borden swore softly, bitterly. Somebody would have to write to her, and he thanked the good Lord it would not have to be him. When a man was killed, the circle of ripples on the pool widened to affect many others than himself. It would seem so light a thing, the death of one man. Yet who knew how wide the effect might be? The letter addressed to Tyrell Sackett was simple enough.
Dear Ty, met a feller name of Heine Kellerman. Used to prospect around. He was in camp the time the colliery used up the boys and Marianne Haley stood by us all, nursing us through it. Tells me she's down eastern Colorado way, almighty sick with lung fever. Him and some of the boys done collected money to send her. Figured you'd be wishful of putting in and seeing it taken to her. Con Fletcher is riding down from Leadville with some more money in his poke. Cap Roundtree.
That must have been the letter that began it all. Or at least began Sackett's part in it. Whatever was going on, if there actually was a connection, had started before that, with the death of Penn Dover. Yet why was he killed? Maybe for something even before that. Returning the letters to the saddlebags, he strapped them up again. Nothing there, except that he might have had an identification right off if Hyatt had given them up, for Joe Sackett's name was here in several places. The worst of it was, he no longer had any excuse for not notifying the Sackett family. Their address was now in his hands. The identification was positive. Once notified, the Sacketts could be here within 4 or 5 days, maybe a bit longer, and he had no solution to lay in their laps. They had a reputation for strict honesty, but for being hard-nosed about one of their own being killed.
and he wanted no interference until he had something to offer. George Riggin had been killed when he seemed to have reached a conclusion, or was close to one. He got up suddenly and drew tight the curtains. Then he sat down and took out Riggin's tally book. On the first page, obviously an old list, were some brands and the number of head found with each. They were out-of-state brands, and evidently a count of cattle picked up on the range, found with rustlers or something of the sort. There was on the next few pages a day-to-day arrest records for drunks, brawls, domestic squabbles, and the like. It was routine stuff. On the fourth page, Dover Pin, investigation of murder. No known enemies. Deceased had $2 in his pocket. No known criminal associations. Reputation for honesty. Good, average hand. Has a woman in Trinidad going on 8 years. No gambling losses or wins of more than a few cents in several years. Jealousy, robbery, and enemies ruled out. No rustling in area. His horse wasn't taken. No tracks near body. Saturday night drinker, good-natured drunk. Local work. Worked 2 summers for Borden Chantry, 3 for Blossom Gailey, employed by Blossom Gailey at time of killing. Last previous job in Mora for S. Lazy S. S.
The Sackett brand. There was the tie-up. But what did it mean?
Joe Sackett had come to town on a simple, peaceful mission. Pin Dover had quit one job in Mora, ridden north, and gone to work on a place where he had worked before, and probably within the past few months or over the years, many a cowhand had done just that. It was the very pattern of existence for them. Shortly after his return, he had been shot. Borden Chantry shook his head, then went back to the tally book, keeping his place with a finger on the line he was reading.
Maybe Pin Dover was killed because of something he had done, something he knew, something he had seen. Maybe something seen or known about somebody here. Worry absent when he was gone, worry increased when he returned. Or something he learned while he was gone.
Ed Pearson had prospected near Mora. He once herded sheep near Mora. Pin Dover punched cows at Mora. Hyatt Johnson said to have been implicated in land-grant fights at Mora. This only rumor, no evidence so far. No connection between Blossom Gailey and Mora. Dover's body found where Old Trail crosses Two Butte Creek. Position of killer found 150 yards to northwest. Small knoll, some brush. Timbered area, good for escape, close behind. Found cartridge shell, .52 caliber in rabbit brush nearby, some evidence killer searched for same. Crispin metallic cartridge shell, used by some units in war between the states. Know of no such rifle or cartridge in area, used in Gilbert Smith weapon. Chantry put the book down on the sofa beside him and sat back to think. Methodically, he went over every detail of the killings. His was a careful mind. He had never considered himself an intellect, just a common-sense sort of man, and that was his only approach. He owned no special knowledge, no remarkable skills. He hoped, by continually re-examining the few odds and ends, that somehow a pattern would emerge. He knew enough of tracking both men and animals to know that most conform to a pattern, that few have originality or deviate from accustomed paths. A deer, for example, will rarely stray more than a mile from the place of its birth. The murderer seemed to be a local man, with local knowledge, and he had to work within the framework of that knowledge. And if there was a cause for killing, it must spring from some source that was locally inspired, or that might affect him, or her, locally. Hyatt had attempted to withhold information. He also had been in a position from which he could have killed Johnny McCoy. Was there any connection between Pin Dover and Hyatt? Between Pin Dover and Blossom Gailey, beyond that he was working for her? Who had been in the barn that night, aside from the murderer and himself? Who owned a rifle of a kind to use that .52 caliber cartridge? In occasional hunts and turkey shoots, Borden was sure he had seen every rifle in the area, but could recall no such gun. George Riggin had not told anyone about the .52 caliber rifle,
and Chantry decided to do the same. It was a clue, although a flimsy one. The only person he could think of as likely to have such a rifle was Ed Pearson. A thought came to him suddenly that should have occurred at once. The rifle that fired the shots at him had not had the heavy boom of a .52, but of a lighter, more modern weapon. So the murderer had more than one rifle. That was not unusual, for nearly every ranch house within miles had two or more rifles, and probably a shotgun, to say nothing of the houses here in town. It was the custom of the country, developed from the need to hunt for food and protect the hearth and home, but also from the feeling that freedom won with the gun might have to be kept with the gun. Here, as in Switzerland, the militia was the people. Mora. It all came back to Mora. Yet might that not be a blind alley? That might be pure coincidence. He had surmised the killer was a local man, working from local knowledge. He was also sure that something he had done had worried or frightened the killer into attempting to kill him. It might have been the discovery of the brand on the dead horse that started it, but it was evidence enough that the killer was watching.
So why not give him something to watch? Why not offer the killer some bait and draw him from undercover?
Suppose Chantry let word get around that he had a source of information, and then he saddled up and rode out. Would he be followed? And if he was followed, would that not be first-rate evidence as to the killer? Yet that meant setting himself up as a target, deliberately putting himself in the way of being shot at, perhaps killed. He got up, put the tally book in his pocket, and started back downtown. Bess called after him, and he turned. She stood in the door, staring after him.
Borden? Will you be long?
Not long. I have to talk to somebody. He went into the jail and nodded to Big Engine, then opened the door to the space where the cells were. Kimbaka came to the bars.
How long am I going to be locked up here? He demanded. If they're going to try me, why wait?
The judge will be along. He's coming this way. Borden put his hands on the bars. Kim, how much of a man are you?
What?
The outlaw's face flushed.
What kind of talk is that? I'm as good as any damn man, and I'll have you—
Is your word any good? I've heard that it was. Kim stared at him, puzzled and wary.
My word's good. I never broke my word for anybody.
Kim, we've got an open and shut case against you. We can send you over the road with no trouble. You know that, don't you?
I'll get me a good lawyer.
It won't help much. But you could help yourself by helping me. If you were to help me, my word to the judge might carry weight.
What kind of help?
I'm going to have to leave town, Kim. Somebody in town wants to kill me. When I go, I want you to watch and see who follows me, at least who leaves town.
How can I watch from in here? I can't see much from that window.
Didn't figure you could. You're going to give me your word that you won't try to escape, and I'm going to turn you loose.
You're what?
I'm going to put you on what they call parole. You can sit around outside, eat in the cafe, have yourself a drink, but you can't leave town. All you've got to do is see who rides out of town and keep your mouth shut.
You trust me?
Why, Marshal, I'm just liable to steal one of your own horses and ride out of here.
That Appaloosa of yours now.
I'll be riding him.
Well, one of the others, then. How do you know I won't do that?
I don't. But I'm betting you're a man of your word. Borden Chantry put the key in the lock and opened the cell door. Come on out, Baca. And just to let folks know you've a right to be out, I'm walking down to the Bon Ton to buy you a cup of coffee. Chapter 14. Lang Adams was seated near the window when they walked in, and Prissy was at a table with Elsie. Hyatt Johnson was at another window table, and all looked up when Borden Chantry walked in with Kim Baca.
Well, Lang looked from one to the other, smiling. This is a surprise.
Big Engine won't be around today, Borden said mildly.
So Baca gave me his parole, and he'll be around town. Taking a chance, aren't you? Lang suggested. I wouldn't blame Buck if he grabbed another horse and left the country. He won't do it. Borden sat down and glanced around. Hyatt was watching him, cup poised, listening, too. Baca gave me his word, and I believe in him. Kimbaka shrugged and glanced at Adams.
He's a trusting sort, and there aren't too many left. He still believes in folks, trusts in a man's word. Why, I do believe he'd hire me to care for his horses.
Chantry turned his eyes to Baca. Want the job? He asked gently. I could use a good man. Lang Adams shrugged.
Baca, you'll find Chantry that kind of man, but whatever you do, don't cross him. If you ever ran out on him, he'd follow you until he died.
Or you did.
He's like a bulldog. Never knows when to let go.
Conversation picked up, and Borden looked out into the night and thought of his next move. He did need Big Engine, and there would have been nobody to care for Baca in jail. Also, he could use Baca.
Secretly, he knew there was yet another reason. Deep inside, he was sure Kimbaka was a good man, a better man than most, yet with a taste for expensive horse flesh and not the money to buy it. Yet given a chance, Baca might become any kind of man he wished to be, and Chantry disliked seeing him go to prison where his future would be twisted the wrong way. Given this chance, he might make good.
And if so, Borden would do as he promised and speak for him to the judge, a man he knew well as a hard-nosed frontiersman. The judge believed in stiff penalties, but he was a man of much experience with the world and aware that all are prone to make mistakes. He would, Borden believed, give Kimbaka a chance. He would also sentence him to hang if he failed to make good. He was that kind of man, harsh yet understanding. Lang Adams was quiet. He talked a little, and when Borden asked him about Blossom Gailey, Lang shot a glance at Baca and did not reply for several minutes.
She's all right, he said at last. Short-handed right now, so I may go help her.
She lost a good hand and pinned over, Chantry agreed. Did you know him?
To speak to? Yes, he was a good hand, by all I've heard.
Killed, wasn't he?
Yeah.
It was Riggins' last case, the one he was working on when he died.
Too bad. He might have found out who did it.
Might have. He would have. Maybe he already had, but now we'll never know. We'll never know how much he knew. But we will get Dover's killer.
You have a lead?
A man always leaves tracks, no matter what he does. George Riggin used to say there were no perfect crimes, just imperfect investigations. Then, when it kills again...
You think he did?
Of course. Borden was speaking just loud enough for everyone in the room to hear, if they were listening. And there were enough people in this room to let everybody in town know what he thought. He killed George Riggin, and then he killed Joe Sackett and Johnny McCoy, and he's tried to kill me.
If I were you, Hyatt Johnson said from the next table, I'd be careful. He's done pretty well so far.
Maybe. But each time he kills, he draws the noose tighter. A man leaves a pattern, and this man has. In fact, he pushed back his chair, I've got a lead, a good lead. That's why I need Big Engine elsewhere, and that's why I'm letting Baca out on parole, so I can be free to follow it up. When I get back to town, I may know just who did it. And why.
Need help? Lang asked. All you've got to do is ask, Board. I'll lend a hand. Any man in town will.
I know, but this is a job I have to do myself.
He got to his feet.
Come on, Baca. Let's get back to the jail. See you tomorrow, Lang, or the next day. You hold that turkey hunt open. I'll wrap this one up, and then we'll do some shooting.
At the jail, he showed Baca to his cell, but left the door ajar.
Good a place to sleep as any, and we both slept in worse. I doubt if I'll see you tomorrow, but keep your eyes open.
I'll do that.
Baca put a hand on the barred door and moved it a few inches.
You really trust a man, don't you?
I trust the right man, Baca.
You think that killer's going after you?
Baca's eyes searched his face.
You think he'll take that risk?
He's got to, Borden said quietly. Look at it. He's running scared. He's killed several times, and now I've told everybody that I've got a